Hello and welcome to The Past and Stuff, the history podcast with Ashley Bozian and Tracy Cooper, where we talk about stuff in the news, our pieces of stuff, and stuff in our lives.
So hello, Ashley.
Hello, Tracy. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. You had a good week?
I did have a good week. It was slow, but in a good way, relaxing. How about yours?
Not too bad. I managed to get some work done. So
work is good.
Aside from the podcast work, you know, so that was good. So I'm in a good place. Okay, so let's, I think it's your turn to go first. So you want to tell me about your stuff in the news?
I would love to. So my stuff in the news is once again environmental. I guess this is becoming a theme for me, but it's super interesting. So why not? I was reading that a site in Canada called Crawford Lake, so it's a lake, it's in Ontario, is being proposed by geologists as the site at which they can pinpoint the beginning of the Anthropocene. Okay. And that's a word that I guess you're probably familiar with that term. Mm-hmm. And it's a word that's been buzzing about among historians for a while. In fact, it was like one of the major themes, if not the major theme, of the 2020 conference of the American Historical Association. So it's been a buzzy term for us lately, but I think most people probably either haven't heard of it or don't really know much about it. So yeah, Anthropocene is... Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to woman explain it to you.
Oh, please do. You can probably do a better job than I can. Please go ahead.
Anthropocene, I think, is the period where you can start to tell at a geological level that man is having an impact on the environment, and we're moving into a new geological age.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. That was much more succinct and concise than I could have done, so thank you. Thank you for woman-splaining. That was quite helpful. So this site, Crawford Lake in Ontario, has been proposed just recently as the site at which we can see this most clearly through sedimentary evidence, through geologic evidence. And I was really surprised because it's not, I was expecting like we would be able to see evidence of human activity or strong evidence of human activity starting with kind of the beginning of what we call civilization, or you know agriculture, about 12,000 years ago or so, the Neolithic Revolution. That's when I was expect, like, that's what I think of when I think of the Anthropocene. But no, they're proposing that it begin in the 1950s. Yeah.
Not the smoky Victorian period?
Right? Well, I guess they're seeing some changes starting around then, but it really kicks up in the 1950s, and they call that the Great Acceleration, which is this major uptick in population and therefore consumption. And they start to see massive sedimentary evidence of things like mass industrialism and all the, you know, garbage we've put into the environment. And around 1945, but then more significantly in 1952, they see evidence, not surprisingly, of nuclear activity. So plutonium in particular, plutonium sediments, that's when that becomes really prominent. But I was just so surprised that they would begin the Anthropocene. So this would cap off the era, or the epoch known as the Holocene, which began at the end of the last ice age, about 11,700 years ago, according to my reading. And I was really, really surprised to hear that, like, humankind's activity shows major geological evidence, not from the beginning of agriculture and all that stuff, but really shows a clear demarcation so recently. That kind of scared me a little, to be honest.
Yeah, that is kind of scary. I mean, I was, you know, at school in the 70s, late 70s and into the 80s. And people were talking about the environment even back then, and pollution. And, you know, you kind of think that once people started talking about pollution, that it would start to get better, not worse. But things have got significantly worse in the last 50 years, I think, which is kind of shocking. But if you think about it, I guess cars, people owning cars, one per household, and all that nasty food packaging, which we never used to have. And then the nuclear testing, I think, You know, I think it's stuff, as we were saying last week, just hangs around for so long. It's really hard.
It is. And it's also, you know, we tend to think of it in terms of like hygiene and all the stuff during the pandemic, like everything was single use and, you know, for good reason. Starbucks stopped letting you bring your own cup, things like that, because they wanted to keep everything hygienic. And certainly single use products are hygienic, but they're also going to kill us in a different way. So it's like, pick your poison.
Yeah. So why this lake? Why this particular lake? Why have they decided on that?
Apparently the geologic evidence is just very clear there. Very obvious there. And this is a method called stratigraphy, where they look at these striations in rock formations. And it's interesting, right before I read this article, like the night before, I had been watching this documentary, this PBS Nova episode about stratigraphy. It was called like The Origins of North America. In fact, it was a really good documentary, so I'll link it in our sources. Yeah, it's a really good watch. I really enjoyed it. It was hosted by the head, I think the director of the Smithsonian Natural History Museum. He was a great host, very engaging. And he was talking about stratigraphy all over North America, really. But in the beginning, he goes to the Grand Canyon and he shows all of these layers and layers and layers of rock, these strata of rock. And he's like, through these sediments, you can see that this is from this period and these sediments indicate this period. And he talks all about what the sediments are, how they scientifically determine which epoch it is. And it was really interesting. So then, as it happened, the next day I read this article. So yeah, I found that really interesting that they were using this method, this stratigraphy, this stratigraphic method to date all the stuff, all the ways in which we've totally messed up our planet.
Yeah, I can imagine the guy from the Smithsonian going, look, the Earth is this old.
It was pretty much like that.
It's not cool, 6,000 years old. It's this old.
yeah. But he did it in a very, in a, just a really cool way that like I could understand it. And I don't really know much about the sciences, like the life sciences or geologic sciences. But like I could see kids enjoying it too. It was just really cool. So I do recommend that documentary. Apparently it was the first in a series of three. So I'll have to watch the other two also, but I'll link the first one that I watched.
Okay, cool. I think I'll take a look at that too.
You would like it, yeah.
Okay, so for my stuff in the news, I have a question for you, Ashley.
Ooh.
Guess where
is
in
it
the
a
world?
Quiz?
Yeah, it's a quiz. Guess where in the world legislation was signed this week that would end child marriage?
All right, well, from the tone of your voice, I'm guessing it's somewhere surprising. So I'm going to go with, you know, I'm going to go with Texas.
It was Michigan, but...
Really?
Yeah.
I wasn't that far off.
So Governor Gretchen Whitmer this week on Tuesday signed in legislation that would end all child marriage under 18 under all circumstances. So previously 16 to 17 year olds were permitted to marry with the consent in writing of one parent. I don't know what happens if the parents didn't agree, but I guess you only need one parent to consent.
Yeah.
And even minors under the age of 16 were able to be married with the approval of a judge. So why is this a big deal? Well, it is not to stop 17-year-old high school sweethearts from getting hitched, as one Republican senator commented. I mean, and if you're 17, really, what's the rush? You know, just hang on.
Just wait.
Just wait until you're not legally a child.
And
it is a big deal because it tries to end sexual exploitation and what's been called a form of slavery. I don't know if you've seen the really disturbing Netflix documentary, Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey.
I started watching it. I don't think I finished it, but yeah, I recall starting it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's about a, you know, nasty child rapist, Warren Jeffs, and his many child brides. And he was the president of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints and had many underage brides. And I just want to point out that they have no affiliation with the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. The fundamentalist in the front there is the important difference. I don't want to offend Mormons. Anyway, so, you know, this is an you know, to end a sort of marriage between young girls and older men, basically. That's what it's about. So between 2000 and 2018, there were 5,259 child marriages in Michigan and around 300,000 in the US as a whole.
Wow.
And the majority of these were not 17-year-old high school sweethearts, but they were girls between 16 and 17 years of age who married a man at least 4 years their senior.
Right.
Okay.
Operative word there, I think, is like at least. Like, at okay, least. 4 years, not gross. 40 years, yeah, gross.
Yeah. And before we think that Michigan was being tardy and suffering some kind of Midwestern backwardness, it's now become the 10th state that has banned child marriage.
Wow.
Why is child marriage considered a form of slavery? Well, at least 95% of these children that were married were girls, and they're not old enough to vote, so they're not old enough to have a legal say. They're too young to enter domestic violence shelters.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're too young to initiate divorce. They can't legally initiate a divorce because they're children.
Wait, so you can get married, but you can't get divorced?
Yep.
And wow.
They have a very limited scope of legal representation for things like the rights to their children, because they are children themselves.
Oh my gosh.
So you don't magically become an adult if you're married. They are still very much legally children. So the bill in Michigan did draw largely bipartisan support, but it wasn't unopposed. There were five Republicans who opposed the bill in Michigan's House. And one total scumbag Republican senator tried to sort of confuse the issue and tag along his favorite issue to it by trying to finagle an amendment which would include a ban on gender-affirming care for minors.
Oh, I was going to say abortion. I was wrong. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that's like totally, disgusting. If either part of this, just putting the two together and saying girls getting married under 18 and people having, gender affirming surgery, you kind of know that people are going to, more people are going to object to the gender affirming surgery so that the bill might be turned down that would protect young girls, or it would just confuse or delay the issue. So I thought that was particularly gross.
Yeah.
The woman that's been spearheading this campaign is called Frady Reese, and she's the founder of Unchained at Last, which has been campaigning to end child marriage, and she herself is a survivor of a forced marriage. And she said, quote, "We're talking about horrific human rights abuses that creates a nightmarish legal trap for minors and legalizes, in some cases, statutory rape, when it involves a child who is not yet 16 and not yet even old enough to consent to sex." So, yeah, I mean, I that really sort of struck me, that a judge can say that, or could say, rather, that somebody under 16 can get married, and anybody having sex with somebody under 16 is statutory rape, but it kind of like is a loophole for that. Michigan now joins Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Rhode Island, New York, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Connecticut, who have all enacted child marriage legislation between 2018 and 2023. So just those 10 states, quite a few more to go. If you're listening from somewhere that wasn't just named, start writing people, I guess.
Yeah, write your congressperson.
Yeah, and in 1989, so way back in 1989, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, which was an international legal framework, became one of the most widely ratified human rights treaties in history. And it declared that childhood is separate from adulthood and lasts until 18. It is a special protected time in which children must be allowed to grow, learn, play, develop, and flourish with dignity. So yeah, that was 1989. This is 2023. I think we could say, you know, it's about time that this UN convention was sort of recognized in more places in US law. So I also looked up Britain and Armenia because, you know, those are the places we're interested in.
Fair enough.
So in the UK, the it was enacted in 2022. So we just got in just before Michigan. That means that 16 and 17 year olds can't marry even with parental consent. And then in Armenia, they signed the Convention of the Rights of Child in 1993 and reinforced it in 1996. Huh. So yeah, go Armenia there.
Wow.
They were early adopters.
So child marriage has been illegal there since then.
Yeah.
Since the 90s. Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that. And I'm really happy to know that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. There's, I was looking at the website, Girls Not Brides. Yeah. And there are a few local issues with non-compliance in Armenia in a couple mm-hmm. of places, but they are tackling those. And yeah, worldwide, the issue of girl brides is a big problem. There are 12 million girls married before the age of 18. Mm. And the website Girls Not Brides breaks this down to 23 girls a minute or one every 3 seconds.
Wow.
Something horrible to think about.
It really is. I'm glad we're talking about this. And I know that in recent years, I guess the past 5-10 years, a lot of organizations, both in Armenia and in the Armenian diaspora, which includes me, have been tackling women's issues like domestic violence, intimate partner violence. And that's been a major movement that's been going on. That's wonderful. I haven't heard, I just, you know, it hasn't been on my radar, child marriage. So when you mentioned it, I got like nervous. I was like, oh no, we're probably going to be one of the worst offenders, but I'm relieved to hear that, again, even if it's not always enforced, at least there's a legal framework for addressing it, and hopefully it'll continue to be enforced and be better enforced. But it's shocking to think about how much of that happens in the United States.
I think in the US, there's this romanticism about marrying young.
Yeah.
About marrying your childhood sweetheart. And mm-hmm. I think that sort of takes it away from, you know, people's understanding of what the reality of child marriage is for a lot of people. Whether yeah. or not it's, you know, by choice or whether it's an arranged marriage, you know, if you're not legally an adult till you're 18, you can't vote. In the US, of course, you can't drink till you're 21. So, you know, imagine being able to, you know, be married 5 years before you're legally sort of deemed adult enough to have an alcoholic beverage.
Yeah. Or, you know, a year before you're old enough to go serve the country at war. Yeah. There's one thing I wanted to address that I listened back to our podcast from last week. And I said something that I think will probably be taken the wrong way, so I want to explain it. So you had mentioned in your stuff in the news that when we were talking about the surnames, mm-hmm. and this person had been punished by being exiled to France, and I was like, oh God, how horrible. So I didn't mean to offend any French people or people who enjoy France. I had a particularly nasty experience in France, so that was... that was why I reacted that way. So what word am I looking for? No offense to the people of France or people who enjoy France. I just, based on my personal experience, will not be returning there.
Yeah, so you're a victim of a crime in another country that kind of puts you off that country.
Yeah, I experienced a violent crime there. And, you know, violent crime, I suppose, can happen anywhere. But what really... you know, twisted the knife in that experience was the police didn't care when I contacted them. And what they said to me was, well, why were you out so late at night?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And first of all, it wasn't that late. It was like 11:30 at night, which I really don't think is that late. I wasn't alone. I was with my friend who lived there. And also, it shouldn't matter what time I was out. The person attacked me physically. So.
No, boo on that person, but not boo on the whole of France. So, Ashley, do you want to show me your piece of stuff?
I would love to show you my piece of stuff. Let me pull it up right now.
Oh.
Yeah.
So it's a little statue of a monkey who is eating something or has something raised to his mouth, squatting on his or her haunches. I should not gender the monkey, seeing as though those parts of the monkey are not visible.
I feel like that should be the name of this episode. Don't gender the monkey.
Don't gender the monkey. I'm guessing this is a baboon by the facial features, maybe.
Oh, smart thinking.
And yeah, because it seems to have like hair or some kind of fashion statement coming out from the sides of its snout there. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to guess this is Egyptian because I think baboons had some significance in Egypt, and that it is 2,500 years old.
Not bad. Pretty good. Pretty good. And you're pretty on track. Any guesses about what this monkey is for? This little monkey statue.
Is it for playing chess? No, I'm joking. It's monkey chess.
Monkey chess.
Is it a perfume container?
It is a perfume container. How did you guess that?
I don't know. Is it at the Metropolitan Museum? I
might have it seen is. It. Have you seen it?
I might have seen it and noticed it. I don't know why that just, and somewhere in my sort of random photographic memory, that was like, oh, maybe I've seen this before.
Yeah. Ding, ding, ding. Good guesses. Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's the first time we've actually completely, one of us has 100% accurately guessed the item.
Okay.
This is an Egyptian perfume vessel in the shape of a monkey. And I think that's actually the name of it that the Met has given it. This is the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. Its dimensions are 6.5 centimeters high by 3.3 centimeters wide by 3.8 centimeters deep. And it has a little like aperture at the top, little opening at the top to allow for liquid to be poured in. And researchers have determined that this liquid was perfume. These were apparently super common in ancient Egypt. So this is from the 18th dynasty in the New Kingdom. It has been dated to circa 1550 to 1295 BCE.
Yeah, so I was only 1,000 years out, which isn't too bad for Egyptian stuff. Considering the length of Egyptian history.
Yeah, so 1550 to 1295 BCE, 18th dynasty. The material is Egyptian, correct me if I'm pronouncing this wrong, faience?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I don't know. Which apparently is different from European, I guess I'm just going to go with faience. And I didn't read that much about European faience because that's not what this is, but this is Egyptian faience, which is, I wrote down some notes. This is made using a ceramic metal with a silicious body, so made from silica, made from sand, and the silica is a compound from sand, and a brightly colored glaze. And further reading indicates that it also contains an alkaline salt sourced from either natron or plant ash, natron being the thing, you know, the salt that they would use to desiccate bodies for mummification.
Okay.
So that's pretty cool. They had a couple of different uses for natron. It also contained minor amounts of lime and a metallic colorant. So this would be fired in, I guess, a kiln or Egyptian equivalent. And during the firing process, the alkali component and the lime would react with the silica in the core to form a glaze on the surface. So it would be like a glazed, shiny object. And that information comes from an article by Carolyn Riccardelli posted on the Met Museum's website. I'll link that as well. But there are quite a lot of these little perfume bottles in from ancient Egypt, especially from this kind of time period, and more recently than this time period. A lot of them are animal shaped, or some of them have, like, I found a number of these, and I'll link all of them because they were pretty cool. They believed that they were ritualistic objects, and that they would hold offerings of fragrance to the dead. So similarly to what we were talking about with the Armenian wine, an offering, libation offering, a fragrant offering. And hieroglyphs kind of confirm this. They have hieroglyphic illustrations of perfume being offered to the dead. So that's pretty cool.
Really interesting. So when I saw this, I thought it was carved from, you know, some kind of semi-precious stone, but it's actually a manufactured object.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's really interesting. And it is very small, as you were saying. It really wouldn't contain a great deal of perfume to be on some Egyptian lady's dressing table and slathered on every morning.
Not enough for me.
So it would be offered with the dead. I'm looking at this, and whatever he is eating or raising to his mouth seems to be a different color. So is this was this once more highly colored than this, and it's faded, or was it different colors?
That's a good question. I didn't find anything about A, what the monkey is eating, or B, what the colors would have been. Although I did come across something that said turquoise was a very common color, and that was associated, I think, with royalty or special occasions or something fun. So turquoise was common, and there would be metallic color in supply to these, but presumably that would have been worn away over the couple of thousand years since then. But yeah, it does look darker in color around the fruit that he's eating, or the nut, whatever he's eating, and a little bit on the front of his hand too, his or her hand. Let's not gender the monkey.
Gender the monkey, yeah. This is fascinating. So apparently when you needed to sort of enter the afterlife, you needed to have your body well preserved and sort of household goods. And if you're Tutankhamun, I guess a chariot and a boat as well. But you also had to smell nice.
That makes perfect sense to me, honestly.
Yeah. It's like, it's a pack me in my overnight bag for eternity, and you're going to put some deodorant in there, aren't you?
Yeah. And so I was reading, this sent me down a rabbit hole of reading about the history of perfume production. And something that kind of made me like think was, I read something that said, and then perfumery, like the art of perfumery, spread from Egypt to Greece. And I thought to myself, like, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I could totally be wrong. But for me, perfumery, like smelling good, is not something that starts somewhere and then spreads. Smelling good, I feel like, is just something everyone has always wanted to do everywhere from the beginning of time, like eating, right? Like nobody invented eating. I was like, hey, have you guys tried putting this stuff in your mouth and chewing and swallowing it? And then it spread. But I could be wrong.
But yeah, smelling good food. That makes sense. And I think about, you have flowers that smell nice, you know, wanting to wear the flower or have the flower in your hair would seem to be a natural sort of very early human instinct. I know there were early Neanderthal graves that had flowers sprinkled in them as part of the ritual. So that sort of idea of wanting to have the nice fragrance would seem to be important. I know that the Egyptian female pharaoh Hatshepsut, she sent a mission down to Punt to get, oh my goodness, was it frankincense or myrrh? It was one of the other. And so this big sort of international sort of trade and diplomacy mission was all about smelling nice and perfume. And the another name for the Silk Road is the Incense Road. I mean, getting stuff that smells nice around these ancient trade highways was as important as semi-precious stones and jewels.
That makes sense to me. As you know, I'm a perfume enthusiast. So for me, like the idea that like someone somewhere would be like, oh, I've discovered that smelling good is nice. And then other people would be like, oh, wow, who would have thought? Like, no. So I don't know. I kind of am skeptical of this idea that perfumery started in one place and then spread. But according to the article I read, it started in Egypt and then it spread to Greece. And there we find perfume bottles that are similar to this and also shaped like animals as well. They also come in shapes of sandaled feet, birds, animals, and human heads. And they're mostly made of...
Do you want to smell like feet?
I'm picturing like the feet of what is it, Apollo or Hermes or Nike? I don't know. With the little feathers. That's Hermes, right? The feathered sandals. But yeah, I don't know.
Maybe this is the perfume bottle for your feet perfume.
Maybe this is the perfume for your monkey.
Yeah. That's why your monkey smells nice. This is very, very important.
I mean, I can see a monkey easily not smelling so nice. So,
yeah, I think if I was a rich Egyptian, I would put perfume on my monkey.
That's not a euphemism. But yeah, that makes sense to me. So a lot of these were glass. Makes sense. A lot of sand in the desert. Sand's good for glass. But in Greece, a lot of these were glass, but a lot of them are also terracotta. And in Egypt, we even find a variety of materials for these. So one of the common materials, they would use alabaster. They would also use a porous stone, I think called anhydrite, which makes sense. It would be porous. And that, I want to do a little more reading about this, but I kind of thought to myself, well, why would you put fragrance oil into something porous? Because that's going to absorb all your fragrance. Like, you're not going to be able to use it. But my thinking, and I have no sources for this, this is just kind of how I'm making sense of it, is they would put that as an offering to the dead. So it would absorb the fragrance, and that way it would be absorbed into the stone. So it wouldn't be like wet, like it would just emanate, it would radiate the fragrance. Or maybe you might wear that as an amulet around you, because that's a thing, right? Like wearing a fragrant amulet. So that way you wouldn't have to mess around with like the oil and getting it on everything. It would just kind of radiate, especially with your body heat, if you were wearing it around your neck. I don't know. That was one thing I thought of.
I know they make perfume out of some pretty disgusting things.
I wrote down some of the non-vegan perfume note sources. And you can tell I probably wrote this when I was half asleep. But some of the sources include whale balls, deer balls, and cat ass.
Cat what?
Cat ass.
Cat ass.
Civet. Okay. Civet from the civet cat, from its ass, from its like anal glands.
Anal glands, yes.
And I don't...
You smell like cat ass is actually a compliment.
Yeah, I think that might have been one of the old 90s perfume ads in the magazines. You smell like cat ass. CK1.
I always think perfume ads are the most ridiculous. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing in perfume ads. They just seem to be a type unto themselves. You know, they're just fantasy, which is, I guess is good. But I guess there's no actual practical, you know, sort of use for perfume that they would want to sort of have in the advertisement. So it's always like somebody, you know, throwing flowers in the air and then twirling in a dress or something.
I actually like perfume ads for that reason, because they tell you what kind of sensory experience the perfume is supposed to evoke. And I find that really creative, even if it's often kind of stupid. I like the ones that are, I like aquatic notes. So like, I love the ones that are like people on the beach just admiring each other's beauty. That's clearly flawless because they're all like 19 years old with perfect skin and a million filters.
And that's what the perfume does for you, I think.
I mean, I keep trying. I don't know. I don't think it's made me 19.
That's why perfume is so expensive.
It contains like virgin blood.
Well, actually, I have no sense of smell, so I'm not a really big perfume user. I got a bad sinus infection sort of in the early 2000s and lost my sense of smell.
Oh my gosh, I never knew that.
Yeah, so before losing your sense of smell was fashionable with the coronavirus.
COVID.
Yeah, before COVID. So I lost my sense of smell, but didn't lose my sense of taste, at least.
Well, that's good.
When it comes to food. I consider myself really, really lucky that I can still enjoy my food. A lot of people lose their sense of smell, also lose their sense of taste. Sometimes I miss it, you know, sometimes I'm like, oh, that would be really nice to know what this smells like, or, you know, I see flowers and there's no point smelling them. But having lived in New York for quite a while, I'm sometimes quite glad I don't have a sense of smell. So I know another perfume substance is ambergris, which is like whale vomit. So
yeah, whale stomach. That's it. I said whale balls, which I guess whales probably don't have balls, but whale vomit. Well, whale like intestinal lining. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
and a number of animal-sourced fragrance compounds are known to or believed to be aphrodisiacs. In fact, something that came up in my reading is that the Romans discovered perfume from the Egyptians or the Greeks, because Romans didn't want to smell nice on their own. And they immediately were like, oh, we're going to use this for aphrodisiacs, which is like pretty on brand for the Romans. Like, here's a new thing. How can we use it sexually?
There seems to be sort of like I'm getting more and more on board with your idea here that smelling nice is not a marker of civilization, and therefore went from Egypt to Greece to Rome, and there spread out from there. That doesn't seem to be necessarily a solid argument.
No, I mean, and I can see the argument that. What smells good is subjective. Obviously, that's subjective. We know this. So different places would have valued different kinds of fragrances. But the idea that smelling good would be something that someone invented, I don't buy it.
No. The first person that rubbed a petal on their armpit and thought, well, that's better.
That's an improvement. But yeah, there is this idea, this use of... fragrance as an aphrodisiac, which makes sense. Like if you want to try to get in a person's pants, you probably want to smell more like a flower than like body odor. And something actually really interesting that came up that I didn't know before that I think makes enough sense that it probably checks out. One of the things I read was that with the rise of Christianity and the spread of it, the use of perfume declined. And at first I thought, well, that's weird. But then I thought about it for 10 seconds and I was like, wait, that makes perfect sense, especially in the areas where Christianity first took off, you know, in the ancient Near East or early medieval Near East, as we might call it, where Christianity came with this assumption of asceticism or this expectation that you would now, you know, you would no longer want to show off like finery and looking good and eating luxurious things and having any kind of luxury associated with you. You want to be ascetic and, you know, not really value worldly things. So that made perfect sense to me. But they what replaced personal fragrance, like something you would apply to the body, was incense. And there's that frankincense and myrrh again. Mm-hmm. And fragrance became something that was sacred, that was holy, that was only applied to like the church structures, like the altar and stuff. And it would be profaning that material to put it on a human body. So we see this, I don't want to say a decline of fragrance, but I would say a transference of fragrance from the person to the church.
And I guess if you just wanted to smell nice, you could sit close to the censer and have some nice smells wafted over you while you were in church.
I think I subconsciously do that, actually, because it just smells so nice.
All right, Ashley, do you want to see my piece of stuff?
I would love to see your piece of stuff.
There we go.
Ooh, it looks like a mask.
It's a mask.
A face mask to be worn on the face. It almost reminds me Full disclosure, I think this is just because I've been watching that show Yellow Jackets. I don't know if you've watched it, but it almost looks like one of those ritual masks that people would wear during like pre-Abrahamic, like pagan rituals when they wanted to like slip into a new identity. Or it might be like my second guess would be like a Jason Voorhees mask because it looks exactly like that.
Like a hockey mask. It's the world's first hockey mask. No, it isn't actually.
Notice that I think of a fictional serial killer before I think of an actual sport. That tells you all you need to know about me.
Yeah, he was wearing a hockey mask, wasn't he? So I think you can be kind of forgiven immensely for not being able to guess the time and place of this mask because it is pretty featureless.
There's no nose. I don't know how the person breathes. Well, I guess through the mouth. There's a little mouth hole, two little eye holes, and that's it. So this could be from anywhere. Is it like bark or something?
It's actually it's a mask called a visard or a vizard, and it was worn by Elizabethan European women. This one is English.
In the
16th century, to protect them from sunburn and from prying eyes. And it's made of three layers. The outer layer would be black velvet. So this is obviously faded here. And then the inner layer would be a stiffener. So either papier-mâché or cardboard or a very thick cotton called buckram. And then the inner layer, going back to what you were saying about perfumes, would be a very soft leather that had been imbued with something, some essential oil or something that smelled really, really nice.
That's going to irritate the skin.
It probably is.
Yeah.
Probably.
And then they would have just had to wear it more to cover up their irritation. It would have been a vicious cycle.
So I'm taking my details for this particular mask from the website of the Portable Antiquities Scheme, and it was found inside a wall in Daventry in Northamptonshire on the 19th of June 2020. And so it's hard to date exactly. They've dated it from 1500 to 1700, but more likely to be 16th century. So it's designated a find of national importance because it's the first full-size Vissard mask ever to be found. We know about them from paintings and from etchings and from poetry and plays. But the only other Vissard mask that's in existence belongs to a doll, a doll of the Elizabethan period with the name, lovely name, Lady Clapham. And she has a little tiny mask too, which is actually constructed very, very much like this one.
Why would they put a mask on a doll? The doll's not going to get sunburned.
Yeah, but ladies wear masks. This is a lady doll. She has to have a mask. I guess it's like Barbie, you know, with her accessories. Maybe so the doll can go out in public.
I think we need Elizabethan Barbie, and this needs to be one of her accessories.
Elizabethan Barbie. So she'd also have a bum roll that was like 6 feet wide. I think that's the, the sort of so you can't actually get through a door without turning sideways. So
and some lead paste to put on her face.
Yes, I'm going to talk about that in the lead paste in a second. So I actually have a picture here of a lady wearing one of these masks and exceedingly creepy.
Yeah.
I would say very, very creepy looking to us and our modern sensibilities.
Yeah.
There's also a gentleman in this painting with a half mask, which was more common. But these,
like the Phantom of the Opera?
Yes, yes. Which was a thing that was sort of very common in, more common in Paris and Venice for men to wear these half masks.
That's so interesting. So is that where, is that like the whole idea of the Phantom of the Opera? He had one of, wow, that's so cool. I didn't know that.
So it wasn't his own personal sort of prosthetic mask. This was something that people would wear out to hide themselves. So this painting, I think, is really cute because this lady obviously has a special mask for going to see a rhinoceros.
I was going to say hippo, rhino. Where's the horn?
Maybe it's a baby rhino.
Aw, it's cute.
It's cute. And it obviously looks nothing like a rhino. But they've got the lady who's there with a child who doesn't have a mask on and somebody who would be her chaperone, her maid, who doesn't have a mask on as well.
But she has it in her hand, though. Like, maybe because she's not as important in status, because she's like her handmaiden or whatever, she can kind of like have a little more freedom with it.
A little more
freedom. She like doesn't matter that much. I don't know.
So the other thing that was interesting about these masks, apart from them being super creepy, is they cover the whole face, and they've, as you say, just got very small holes for the eyes and a little bit of a raised bit in the middle for the nose and a slit for the mouth. So they are sort of thicker and shaped a little bit for the nose. but they must have been very difficult to breathe in. I think we've all had experiences of, you know, not really liking wearing a mask recently. And talking about the size of the little tiny mouth hole there, you might not be able to see too clearly, but there's also a piece of white cotton coming out near the mouth with a black bead attached to it.
I was going to ask about the bead. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is how the mask was kept in place. So the woman would put the bead in her mouth.
Ew.
A button in her mouth to keep the mask on. So there's no ribbon or there's no holes in the side of the mask, if you can notice that. And so, yeah, they would put the bead or a button inside the mouth and sort of keep it between the teeth, which also meant that the woman couldn't talk while she was wearing the mask. So this
I feel like that's like you're going to need orthodonture after years of doing that.
Yeah. So it did mean that the mask could go on very quickly. So as I said, the masks are not just English, they're also Venetian as well, where they're called Maschera Moretta, which means dark mask, or Serva Muta, which means silent servant, because, of course, a woman with a button in her mouth or a bead in her mouth can't speak very well. So I'm going to talk about the cultural significance of this masking in a little bit. But I just want to talk a little bit more first about the Daventry mask and where it was found, because the context of its find, I think, is pretty significant. So as I said, it was found within a wall cavity, and garments placed within a wall cavity were usually done as a deliberate act. And the University of Southampton is currently researching items that have been concealed this way. At their, you can access this at their website, concealedgarments.org. So the most common item to be deposited in this way seems to have been a shoe, but perhaps these just have greater survival rates because they're more robust, they're more sturdy than other garments. And because I think when people are making alterations to an old building, etc., you're more likely to recognize a shoe for a shoe, rather than a random piece of cloth for some kind of important old garment. So the Deliberately Concealed Garments Project provides a virtual collection of objects of clothing that were hidden by owners or residents or by builders inside the fabric of buildings. And sometimes, like this one, they were intentionally sealed shut afterwards. I have never seen an argument because these were high-valued items. Very often the shoes are deposited singularly and not in pairs. But it might have been a device to ward off evil and other maleficent forces. Or it could have been used as counter magic to deflect a curse or deflect some kind of negative circumstance that might be heading that person's way.
That's interesting because when we put the, like in my culture, we put like the evil eye places, and now it's common to like wear it like in jewelry, but what it's originally supposed to, you know, the original way to use it is like you put it somewhere no one sees it. So like my family has one in like their closet because people aren't supposed to be able to see it. It works like behind the door, like behind closed doors, like behind the scenes.
Oh, I never knew that. When I've seen them used, it's usually like on the outside of something. Yeah. So windows and doorways and things like that.
They become more conspicuous.
And also painted on the front of boats I can't remember, maybe Cyprus, somewhere I went on holiday as a child. But the idea of concealing it inside something for protection is also valid. They might also have been considered as lucky things, as heirlooms from an ancestor or from another person that was considered to be spiritually powerful. So if you're, you know, great Auntie Betsy, was a seer or something like that, putting one her old girdle inside your wall might sort of extend the protection that person might have been able to offer to the house, to provide luck to the house. Or it might have just been something like somebody constructing or altering a building and wanting just to leave their mark, a little something of themselves. It's like a time capsule sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think I did it when I was a little girl. My father built me like a shelf around my bed, which was sort of an enclosed shelf. So it was just, it came out. And, you know, there was a little gap at the top. So I put in a couple of pennies and a little note with my name on it. Hi, this is Tracy. I'm age 7 or something like that.
Aww, that's cute.
So I think, you know, there's this idea that somebody might sort of find this when that particular sort of bed construction was pulled down. And your house is a very weird place. It's kind of very personal. It's where all your personal and private stuff happens. But then you have this idea in your head, I think, that at some point somebody else is probably going to live there.
Hmm.
And maybe wanting to connect to that person in the future. Anyway, I want to move on now to talk about the cultural significance of masking. And you know, full disclosure, in my not so humble opinion, I think it should be up to a woman what she wants to wear whenever she wants to wear it. And this applies equally if you're a French woman who wants to wear a bikini to a pool in France. So a bikini is like a full body swimming costume, sort of. So they've crossed the words burqa and bikini. And these are illegal in lots of parts of France. But in Grenoble in France, the mayor has pushed for them to be legal. And this was approved in May 2022.
Hmm.
So you can wear a bikini in the pool in Grenoble, France. And that had a lot of community support for that bill as well. And this was much to the chagrin of people like far-right leader Marianne Le Pen, Marine Le Pen, who called the full body covering swimsuit a threat to French secularism.
Wow.
So I say pish posh Le Pen, and that makes no sense whatsoever, you know. I also think there's women who wear a full body suit or sometimes trying to protect themselves from the sun as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I was thinking that too. When you were talking about this, it reminded me of Islamic head coverings or facial coverings. And I was going to actually make the same comment. Like, it should be about a woman's choice. If she wants to dress, you know, if she wants to wear a hijab or a burqa, whatever she wants to wear, it should be her choice. If she doesn't want to wear it, she shouldn't have to wear it. But this does kind of remind me of this idea that, like, oh, a woman should be covered and she shouldn't be able to talk. So it's like, listen, if you want to wear this, knock yourself out. Be free to do so.
Because on the other hand, you have like Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody in Tehran in September 2022.
That's right.
You know, after being arrested by the Iranian morality police for allegedly not complying with the headscarf code or the strict dress code on head coverings. And of course, there was a lot of protests after that, and they were brutally put down by the government. And hundreds were killed, thousands were jailed. And I actually followed this up by reading a report from the NPR about what the situation is in Iran at the moment. And this was from March of this year, an article by Fatima Tanis, who described the situation on the ground in Iran as kind of ambiguous. The government has sponsored posters at airports and malls and restaurants and even billboards telling women they must keep their headscarves on. But there is a visible minority of women in Iran who are not wearing their headscarves as part of a defiant protest against the government.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, these issues of what is appropriate, whether women choose to do it or choose not to do it, are still very, very modern. And the reason I chose those two examples, the bikini in Grenoble and the case in Iran at the moment, was because there was a lot about female agency. in there. And I think we have to think about female agency when we think about these 16th and 17th century vissards. I mean, when I first read this, I was like, this is appalling. You know, these poor women with this, you know, their whole face covered by this thing and having to wear this bead in their mouth to keep the damn thing on so they can't even speak. And, you know, I sort of like went on a little bit of an internal rant about how terrible this was. But this was a fashion choice. It wasn't mandatory. For most part, it wasn't mandatory. And it wasn't even really customary. It was a fashion amongst high-class women. And, you know, forgive me if I'm wrong on this, and if anybody wants to correct me on this. It was about complexion, but it was to keep an elite white woman's face white, because that was what was fashionable. And it seems to have been less about race than it was about class, because it was if you had to a sun-kissed skin, let's say, wasn't suggesting of health and vitality like it is today. It showed that it was an unavoidable consequence of having to labor outside. So it was unfashionable to be tan because that sort of equated you with a peasant. So that's my understanding from what I've read about the sort of race versus class aspect of these masks. And as I said, it seems to be a choice to wear this. So I was thinking, about strange fashion choices. Do you remember any strange fashion choices from your youth?
Yeah, I grew up in the 90s, so yes, I do. I don't know how detailed you want me to get, but I think it's enough for me to just say I grew up in the 90s.
Well, I grew up in the 80s.
Even worse.
So yes. Do you know what dealy boppers are?
I feel like I've heard of them. I can't visualize them.
Okay, so dealy boppers are like a headband that you wear that have two large erect springs coming out of the top of them, and then attached to the top of the springs, there's pom-poms.
Oh, I had those when I was a little kid.
Yeah. Okay. So those were invented in 1982. And so I would have been about 13 then. And they were around. I think I rejected them. This is, or maybe this is my sort of retelling, my unreliable narrator of my own life. Because it was around 13 that I really got into heavy metal, and I had a Motorhead t-shirt, and I got my first album, and it was Ace of Spades, Motorhead. I think I would have rejected them, but maybe I'm just making that up. Maybe I wore them in private or something. as well as like this idea of keeping the sun off the face, which is the most commonly touted reason for women to choose to wear a visard. Women also applied a lot of cosmetics, as you were saying, to make their skin very, very, very white. So this heavy white makeup was made popular by Queen Elizabeth I because she had smallpox.
And I didn't know that.
When she recovered from smallpox, she was left with pock marks, and then she covered them up with this makeup product known as Venetian Cerussa. And this was a potentially lethal mixture of lead and vinegar. So this type of makeup wasn't unique to Elizabethan England. It's also been found in ancient Greece and in ancient China. It created a look which the journalist Inku Kang has described as perilously close to Ronald McDonald cosplay. And I just can't get that image out of my head now. Every time I see a picture of Elizabeth I, I'm going to sort of morph her face into Ronald McDonald. So
she does have that red hair.
Yeah, thanks for that that image, Inku. So ladies of a certain class would slather this white paste on their faces and necks and across their décolletage, their sort of exposed part of their breasts. And the fashion was for very low-cut gowns. So it's quite a lot of real estate that you're pasting lead onto. And to make things worse, they left it on for a long time, at least a week.
Oh, no.
Yes, I thought this would shock you.
Yeah.
Shock and horrified Ashley face I'm looking at there.
yep.
And to make things worse times two, they commonly used a facial cleanser after leaving the stuff on for a week that was a concoction of rose water, honey, eggshells, and mercury.
Oh, good. Okay. Now, I appreciate the attempt to exfoliate with the eggshells, if that's what they were doing, but I use rose water and honey quite a lot, and they're great for the skin. They're not cleansing. They don't do that. Maybe rose water if you use it with like a cotton ball or something, but... Mm-hmm. But so I guess maybe the mercury
was the active ingredient.
Yeah, I was going to get there. I don't think it did anything positive. I feel like that's kind of the elephant in the room.
Yeah, it did leave the skin soft and smooth. But this was because it was actually eating it away.
Well, I mean, you know, good old-fashioned exfoliation does that. But I guess I wouldn't class mercury under good old-fashioned exfoliation.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, lemon juice or something. Even that's not great for your skin, actually, but it's better than mercury.
Yeah, and they did use lemon juice to try to
lighten
the skin as well. I used to put it in my hair when I was younger to try to add highlights.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it did. It just made my hair nasty and brittle.
Yeah, me too. No, it wasn't great, but, you know, still better than mercury.
Better than mercury. And then to make things worse, times three, they wore red pigment on their lips and cheeks, which were often made from additional heavy metals. But then it became common to use lipstick because it was magic.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, because it was made from ground up cochineal beetles.
Very common in Armenia, actually. I think that's one of their largest exports.
Really?
Yep.
I remember my mother had bought bottles of cochineal to sort of make cakes pink and stuff like that, but she never told me about the association with beetles. I don't think I'd buy that. But the cochineal beetle is actually native to Mexico. So it was one of the, you know, sexy new products out of the New World during the Elizabethan period. And it was considered to be healing and magical. The potato was considered to be an aphrodisiac at the same time.
It's funny to think about that today.
Yeah, that might just be a historical urban legend. I have no source for that. It's something I've heard.
I mean, like, it was exotic at the time because it was new, and it enabled people to really live a lot longer because it was so high in carbs and sugar and calories. I mean, living longer, I guess, could be sexy. Like, hey, I'm a good choice for a mate because I'll be around for a while. Like, I could see that working.
Yeah, that works. So eventually, England's Parliament passed a law outlawing the use of makeup to deceive a man into marrying a woman as a form of witchcraft.
Wait, this is not where I thought you were going with that. So not for health reasons. This is the same, we're going to bring it back to incels. This is the same argument that incels use when they say that women wearing makeup is false advertising. And they do call it that.
Yeah, but this was witchcraft.
Same thing.
The lipstick.
False advertising,
is
witchcraft.
Magical, because it's made out of these magical beetles from Mexico.
Okay, episode name. Magical beetles and gendering the monkey.
Yeah. So then to complete the weird clown look, I'm forgetting, this is to make things worse times four, maybe. A woman might put eye drops in her eyes to make her pupils dilate, made of belladonna.
What's belladonna?
It's a poison.
Oh, good.
Poison. I don't know if you've ever seen like the little purple flowers with the pink, with the yellow centers.
Yeah.
That's belladonna, and it has blackberries, so don't eat those.
Yeah. It's poison?
It's poisonous, yes.
Can you like have it in your garden or it'll just kill you?
It's a weed, yeah. So you just shouldn't eat it. If you have it in your garden, pull it up so your children don't eat it.
Oh, I don't have that problem, but
okay. Somebody else's children don't eat it.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't, that's not my problem either. You watch your own kids, but I'll make sure not to have that around.
But then the sort of ironic thing is, you know, if a woman lived through putting her makeup on, she would then put this black velvet visage over the top so nobody could see her face anyway.
And to really press it into the skin.
Yeah. Press it into the skin, leave it on for a week.
Great idea.
I was thinking that another reason a woman might have chosen to wear a visard is because the roads were so bad. And so it would kick up a lot of dust, you know, while she was riding on the back of her horse or something. And that might be a reason, you know, there was no pavement. So in the summer, it would get very dusty. And then that would mingle with the week old makeup, give the wrong look. But perhaps the bigger reason behind the restrictive mask is that it actually allowed a woman a greater degree of personal freedom. So visards seemed to be popular for women to wear to go to the theatre because at the time plays were a little bawdy and colourful. They had some blue humour and double entendres, and they weren't a suitable place for a woman to be seen, for a lady to be seen. So the visard allowed a higher class lady to attend the theatre while not being publicly outed for attending the theatre. And so this actually turned into quite a game of guessing who the visarded ladies were at the theatre. And there's a few poems that have been written about, you know, the wags and the wits who made a sport out of this and didn't pay attention to the play at all, but were trying to figure out who the lady in the visard was. And it was also a time when a woman, you know, might risk a scandal by venturing out in public without a proper male chaperone. And so a visard might be employed to bring her greater freedom of movement, to go about her business, to go to market, to go to church, to take care of business without having to be escorted by a man.
That's really interesting you're saying that, because this is something I talk about when I teach World History One. Like, scholars have noticed this since the beginning of settled agricultural societies, really. Like, with the advent of domesticity, there was this expectation that women, especially women of high status, in fact, mostly women of high status, had to stay in the house. I don't know if the idea was that they were property, they were domestic property, but yeah, I guess that would have been a big part of it. And so they would veil, and we see this in ancient Mesopotamia, we see it in Greece, they would veil as an extension of the house itself. So they could kind of take the house with them by veiling, by covering their hair and their faces. And that would allow them to kind of go out without leaving the house, because the veil was an extension of the house. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'm going to link a really good article that I typically assign to my students, House and Veil in Ancient Greece by Lloyd Llewellyn Jones. Don't let me forget to do that.
Okay, yeah, sounds good. I haven't read that.
It's a good one.
So in a 1673 comedy by Edward Ravenscroft, one of the characters says, quote, "Under the visard, the wife goes to the play, ball, or masquerade undiscovered to her husband, the daughter or niece unperceived by her relatives." So this is, you know, while my initial reaction to the visard was, oh my God, those poor ladies.
Yeah, me too.
It might have actually been more freedom. So the cultural implications of these visards were quite profound. And they became more and more popular in London, Paris, and Venice, as I was saying. In Paris, they were often placed on a stick rather than held in the mouth. And the ladies then sort of used them sort of coquettishly as a way to sort of flash their faces or, you know, and a little instrument to flirt with.
That's kind of cute.
Yeah, I think that's kind of cute. I wouldn't mind one of those. I use it to teach with.
I'm taking questions. I'm not taking questions.
This is my, I approve of your face. I'm painting it on so you can't see my real face going, what are you talking about?
I think we all need those.
Will you please wake up now? Put down your phone. The big smiley, like Joker smile.
It's like the mayor from The Nightmare Before Christmas. Do you remember that? The movie?
No.
Oh my gosh, the mayor has two faces, and one of them is like a really happy smiley face, and then when he's mad, it turns around, and it's like a sad, angry face. Yeah.
I remember that now, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, in Venice, it actually these masks actually allowed for more social exchange because Venice had become a highly stratified society, even though it was a republic. And this meant that people of both sexes, because men wore usually the half mask in Venice, and so they could meet and communicate with each other more freely in theatres and cafes and markets and parks, etc. Or at the casino, which was a thing that was invented in Venice. These were secret salons, actually in the apartments of the elite, because gambling was illegal. But it took place anywhere way in these casino, in these apartments of the elite. And so everybody there was masked. And there's actually a painting by Pietro Longhi, the same guy that did the rhinoceros painting, that shows both men and women gambling wearing these masks in Venice. And mask wearing culturally evolved as well. It was taken up by sex workers. And if you think about it, it's kind of useful. They could hide their true identities, which, might be very useful because sex workers were targeted by various governments in various ways. We'll probably talk about that at some point.
As they still are.
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. But it also served to pique the curiosity and of their punters and titillate them a little bit, especially when the women were dressed as aristocrats. So if we have high class sex workers sort of dressing as aristocrats, attending functions with a visard on, the titillating guessing game that I was talking about that was going on at theatres became even more titillating when the local wits and wags wanted to guess not just who a woman was, but whether she belonged in society or not, when there was that possibility.
That's so interesting. Because I think in the article I was mentioning to you, or I might have read this in a different text, but in certain places it was illegal for women of lower status to veil themselves because it was seen that they were dissembling to be of higher status than they were. Especially prostitutes, they weren't allowed to veil because they had to, I mean, they were public property, so only private property, domestic property would veil.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clear cut. So by the end of the 17th century, the trend of wearing a visard was under attack. And the term visard actually became slang for a sex worker. And in England, Queen Anne, believing they promoted vice, banned the visard from theatres in 1704. So this makes me kind of wonder a little bit, though I have no evidence at all for it, why this visard might have ended up inside a wall. Maybe somebody was secreting their visard so, you know, they could be secretly masked. But I'm just guessing. So in Venice, the backlash against mask-wearing women was even earlier. It was in 1608 that sex workers wearing masks could be punished for posing as quote-unquote honest women. And if they were found guilty, they'd actually be chained for 2 hours between two columns in the Piazza San Marco. So a very, very public place.
So similar to these ancient societies where it was illegal to feign this higher status through covering the face.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Venetians couldn't make up their minds. And a century after this, a punishment for sex workers wearing masks, the government did a U-turn and then required all sex workers to wear masks to go to theatres and casinos, etc. So obviously their punishment wasn't working, so they just decided to go this. And then in another U-turn, which would make the British government proud, they again flip-flopped on the idea about who should be wearing masks. And it was a law was passed in 1776. They passed another decree that required all nobles to wear masks in order to guard against, quote, a dangerous immodesty of the supposedly decent classes.
Was that men and women or just women?
That was men and women.
Wow, okay.
And so this is where we get the Venetian culture of mask wearers. You know, so when you go to, if you go to Venice, you know, the masks are everywhere and very famous, especially in the annual carnival celebrations before Lent as part of that culture.
Is this where we also get masked balls, like masquerade balls?
Yes, yes. That's the sort of, let's sort of play at this Venetian culture, I guess. So, the sort of the idea of woman, you know, either on the pedestal or in the pit, is very much sort of reflected in this legislation about mask wearers.
Well, and also it looks just creepy. Like, I associate that kind of mask with like a serial killer. Mm-hmm. So for me, I my reaction was Jason Voorhees. But you know, it was interesting. I was listening to you talk about this, and I can see a lot of benefits to choosing, not being forced, but choosing to wear that mask. Because, like, we've all had the experience. I think many women have had the experience of being leered at, like, on the street, on the train, you know, whenever you leave the house. And it's uncomfortable. And then the catcalling and just, it's really uncomfortable. So I have actually, like, if I know I'm going to be literally just stepping outside of my house, I will cover myself to some degree. I'll make sure that I'll put my hair back. So because I have long hair and that tends to attract, you know, gross catcalls. Or like face masking during COVID had, you know, that positive effect that I could hide most of my face between that and sunglasses. Or like I'll even try to show less skin, even if it's hot. And it's like, I don't want to do those things. I don't like enjoy doing that, but I prefer it to being leered at. And actually, as I'm saying this all out loud, I'm realizing like, no, like that's not the, like the problem is that people do that people leer and catcall, but
yeah,
so it might make me want to cover my face. So
yeah, I was reading, and I have no details for this, I'm going to look this up, but I saw this article, it might have been from the New York Times, about women wearing large oversized men's dress shirts, you know, like a long dress shirt over the clothes that they're going to the club in or going out, you know, for dinner in, so that they can travel safely on the underground. So it is a thing. So we've got perfume monkeys you know, dodgy masks.
Let's see, perfume monkeys and something like that.
Yeah, perfumed monkeys and masked madams, I guess.
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
Like that. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah. We'll go with that one.
Okay. We'll go with that.
Okay, so what's been going on in your life? What's the stuff in your life this week?
I actually have some really exciting stuff to report in my life. So there is this book that I've been looking for literal years. And it is a 1971 critical edition. I think it's a critical edition, but it's the only copy. It's the only version we have of the original classical Armenian text of this particular document. And I have an English translation that was made by a guy who had access to this 1971 text. And he writes in his introduction, I'm basing this on the 1971 text. So I've been looking everywhere for this 1971 text, and it was nowhere. No, you know, it was really hard to find. It was not digitized. And finally, I resigned myself. So I looked in WorldCat, and I resigned myself to having to go to one of the few libraries in the world that had it. But it kept disappearing. Like, I would bookmark a WorldCat record for it, and then I would try to go back to the bookmark, and it would disappear. So I don't really know what's going on. Anyway, the good news is, in my frantic trying to like get my hands on this, and when my WorldCat records disappeared again, because I was about to email a library in Boston that had a record of it, and of course that record disappeared, and I was like tearing my hair out. So I just googled the text one more time, and you'll never guess what came up for the text.
It was for sale.
Any guesses where?
A books.
Better.
Where?
eBay.
It was just there on eBay.
eBay for $40.
For $40? Oh my god! Yeah.
I think it's like it qualifies as a rare book. There was only one printing of it. There printed 1,000 copies, So there's only 1,000 copies of this book in the world. Granted, I don't know how many people really need it, but I need it. And so I bought it and I got the confirmation. So it should be shipping to me this week. And the seller was nice enough to include some images in his list, his or her listing. I'm not going to gender the seller or the monkey. included some images of the first few pages of the text. So I was able to make sure that it was the same text I was looking for. I cross-referenced the Armenian text with my English translation that I have by a scholar called Robert W. Thompson, who I think passed away recently, actually. And it is the same text. So, and the seller says there are no missing or damaged pages. So I'm really, really excited to get this text. It should be coming in a couple of days, and I will digitize it immediately for the benefit of other people who might need it, and also for my own benefit, because I will probably lose or damage this book because it's me. So I'm really excited about that. I'm super happy I found this book finally.
And I think it's part of a bigger point. I think people don't realize just how much stuff isn't on the internet. I think a lot of my students assume that if it's not on the internet, it's not true.
Or that there, you know, and if it is on the internet, it must be true.
It's on the internet, it must be true. And, you know, that if you want to research anything, I mean, I do research for our shows mainly on the internet. I will be honest about that. But there are sources that are available on the internet, which you can't get out without license, for one thing. But then there's other sources, you know, that are just not digitized at all. You know, any paywall.
And I was worried, like, if I can get to a library where they have this, are they going to let me scan it?
Yeah, I think legally you're not supposed to do the whole thing.
Yeah, so I mean, I was getting really nervous, mm-hmm. and so let's hope and pray that when I get this text, it's has all the pages, nothing's missing or damaged, and I will share it with the world, legally or not.
Share it with my underground Armenian academic mafia, because
I mean, I feel like it's just going to be me and like four other nerds who will use it, but you know what, I'll give it to the four other nerds, so.
I appreciate your excitement.
Thank you.
Stuff in my life this week was quite unexpected, and that was I saw a bald eagle, and I heard a bald eagle as well.
Wow, did you get your dog inside immediately? Because they'll go for it.
It wasn't outside, it was in a cage. So it's not quite as exciting as that, but I went to this outdoor discovery center, which looked kind of small and not like very significant from the outside, but it had paid paths, and because my partner's in a wheelchair, that's sort of one thing we always look for. And so we went to look at the birds of prey, and it was kind of after hours as well, so I thought it would all be sort of shut up and we were just really going for the walk. But no, they had the birds of prey were all sort of visible, their cages were outside, so it was fantastic. And all their birds had been injured in some way, had eyes or wings missing or been hit by cars or something, so they wouldn't have survived in the wild. But I always wondered what happens to wild animals. Apparently I know what happens to some of them. So they started off, and there was like this tiny little owl, which kind of weighed the same as an apple, you know, so they're giving you these comparisons with how much they weigh.
Wow.
And then you sort of go the around the building, and there was a Cooper's hawk. I didn't know I had a hawk named after me, so that was kind of exciting.
You too.
And then I heard this sort of prehistoric dinosaur sound, which sounded just like, you know, something like the velociraptors from Jurassic Park or something.
I just watched Jurassic Park last night. That's funny. Classic.
Which was really creepy. And then it's sort of like, I was like, oh my God, it's a bald eagle. And, you know, so I'm like 3 or 4 feet away from this bald eagle, maybe a little bit further than that. I'm not very good at distance. So 10 feet away from this bald eagle. And oh my God, they are the scariest looking thing I've ever seen.
Really? How big was it?
Well, it weighs as much as a bowling ball. I know I found that out. It's got to be like 3 foot tall. It's like the size of a toddler, I guess.
Okay. I mean, that by itself is scary enough to me.
Yeah. But when they look at you, they're just sheer alien. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Well, they're, I mean, they basically are dinosaurs, right? They're like evolved dinosaurs.
Yeah. And I mean, it's just so like scary.
Yeah.
I mean, it was in a cage and I wasn't actually, you know, scared. But, you know, like, sort of one
it
was,
could get out of the cage. You don't know.
If I woke up and one was hitting me in the face with a frisbee, I'd be terrified.
I don't know. I think Kitty could take a bald eagle and a dinosaur.
And a dinosaur, probably, yeah. So, no, but they are just very, very impressive looking creatures. And it's, you know, something unexpected, you know, like, let's just go to this place because we've never been. And they seem to have pathways and we can sort of exercise a little bit. And then coming, you know, that close to a bald eagle was something I'll probably remember for the rest of my life. So a very
That's really cool.
happy little event this week. Okay, Ashley, well, it's been nice chatting to you once again.
You as well. Always fun.
Okay, take care.
You too. See you next week.
See you next week.